This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We are here to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Warren Reinch.
Hi.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We sent the August edition of the Trumpet to press yesterday, and in it is an article from Brent Noctegal titled, Will America and Iran Go to War? I'll just read the beginning of this article. It says, the shift is stark. Barack Obama wanted Iran as a friend of America. Donald Trump recognizes Iran as ruled by radical mullahs as an enemy. The former president's efforts enabled Iran to reach new heights in power, to underwrite increased terrorist activity throughout the region, and accelerate its pursuit of nuclear weapons. The current president has sought to reverse those Iranian gains through renewed economic pressure, threats of force, and a stronger American military presence in the region. Will these tactics work? Evidence is negligible that Iran will back down easily. A series of attacks and belligerent acts shows that Iran will not go down quietly or without a fight. Tensions in the Middle East are growing. Will the United States and Iran go to war? We're going to talk about an even greater escalation that has happened this week. Start by having Warren Reinch describe another Iranian provocation over an American drone. Warren.
Thank you. So the Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps announced Thursday morning that it had downed a U.S. drone. This drone it described as a $200 million giant, which has been estimated to take about $222 million just to build. This drone was, according to Iran, flying in Iranian airspace. The U.S., though, said that it was international airspace, so it is a little disputed at the moment where this drone was going at the moment. President Trump just tweeted recently that they had actually called a strike in Iran, and as this drone was flying through, it was doing some reconnaissance. He called the mission off because a general said that there would be 150 deaths. So this tweet here says that Trump said that this was not a proportionate number, so he basically called off the strike and allowed the drone to be shot down.
So I guess we'll see yet what the American response is going to be, since they decided to call off that strike. But this is definitely a very strong provocation by Iran, shooting down this $250 million drone of the United States. But this is actually the last of several provocations that Iran has been making against the United States. Brent talks about several of them in that article. We've talked about on this show quite a bit about the attacks on oil tankers in the Middle East. And there's quite a lot of evidence that Iran is working to drive America specifically out of Iraq as well.
Yes, that has also been going on a lot. This week, there's been a recent barrage of four attacks against American bases and oil infrastructure just in Iraq alone. This has all started on Saturday when three mortar shells landed at a U.S. airbase in just north of Baghdad. There was no damages, and there was no claim of responsibility for the attack. The same thing basically occurred on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, all different bases. Were attacked. The difference is that the Wednesday attack was on an American oil company. This was where there were actually three injuries reported. But in all of these attacks, there were no claims of responsibility. And despite all the no claims of responsibility, all the evidence looks like it's pointing to the Shiite militias that were part of the Popular Mobilization Units, the PMU. Everyone seems to think that this group is responsible for the attacks. The PMU, if anyone doesn't know, it's this group of Shiite militias. They were fighting against the Islamic State in the Iraqi Civil War, and they were in many cases led by or trained by Iranian officials. So they are trained by and also backed and supported financially, militarily by Iran.
So we've seen, obviously, the United States has had a presence there for 16, 17 years. But we've seen this presence that Iran has in that country growing steadily over that time, and more pressure, even by Iraqi lawmakers, to push the United States out of there. Maybe you can just talk about the bigger picture as to, say, what's happening in Iraq with this shift of influence from America to Iran.
And I think that's where this really gets interesting, because when we talk about the PMU isn't just a military organization. A lot of these militias have political wings, and they actually formed a party in the government, and now they're working in the parliament. So in the recent elections, May of 2018, there was a parliamentary elections. A lot of these PMU militias formed a party called the Fatah Alliance, and they ended up winning the second most amount of seats in the parliament, which is pretty crazy when you think about this group. These are obviously, many of them are U.S. designated foreign terrorist organizations, and they're working now in the Iraqi parliament. A lot of them are either the militia men themselves, or they are just politicians who are affiliated with these PMU militias. But way back in 2016, the Prime Minister created this executive order, which made the PMU a state organization, which also at the same time forbid them from actually going into the parliament, from running for parliament, for being involved in politics. But nonetheless, 500 members of this PMU militia still ran for parliament, and many of them are in office now, which is pretty amazing to think about.
So just watching Iran's influence increase in Iraq, even in the parliament, even among the politicians, it's exactly what the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has been saying was going to happen, really from the very beginning, even before the United States launched an attack in 2003.
Yeah, even as early as 1992, Mr. Flory has mentioned that he saw Iran being that nation that is going to be this king of the South, the biblical power. But he has this really sweet quote. It's really enlightening when you look at it. This was written before the 2018 elections, and this is what he wrote. He said, quote, "Iran is working through standard political and diplomatic channels to position itself to be able to hold stock in the new Iraq, working with the Iraqi government, cementing economic ties, and exploiting other diplomatic channels."
Yeah, so he's saying this years ago, and we're seeing it come to pass now. But what's interesting is Iran is making these moves in the context of a lot of economic pressure that the United States is applying to Iran. Its economy is really suffering right now because of these economic sanctions that the United States is applying, and pushing its military presence in the region. There are a lot of people who are really upset at Donald Trump and they're accusing him of being the one who's escalating this into a possible war. So there's quite a lot of tension right now over what the next move may be. And I'd like to just look at this in the context of what's happening in Europe. This was, again, one of just the latest of several attacks by Iran. Brent Nachtigall describes those in that Trumpet article. What is Europe's reaction been to these events? For this, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, I thought we saw something kind of stunning from Europe, and especially Germany and Germany's foreign minister, Heiko Maas, this week. So you had these attacks on these boats that we talked about on last week's show in the Straits of Hormuz. The United States released video saying, look, this shows Iran is behind it. They said, we've got a lot of evidence. We're very sure Iran did this. You've then got all of the background of Iran threatening to do this. Iran's track record as a rogue state committing exactly these kind of attacks. So you've got the world's number one democracy and the world's most powerful democracy, say, pointing the finger at Iran. On the other side, you've got the world's number one sponsor of terror saying, no, this wasn't us. The United States is making all of this up as an excuse for them to attack us. Now, when you look at those two sides of this argument, it doesn't take a genius to figure out who's right.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the country with a track record of lying and committing terrorist attacks versus, like I said, the world's most prosperous democracy. The stunning thing is that Europe looked at that, led by Germany's foreign minister, and said, yeah, we're not sure. We're not sure who to believe here. America, well, they could be telling the truth. They could be lying. Or, well, maybe Iran could be telling the truth. Or they could be lying. We don't know. He talked about the German foreign minister talked about, well, you know, America lied to us and they tricked us in the Iraq war. You remember what happened with the weapons of mass destruction. So we're not sure what's going on here, which is a pretty huge vote of no confidence in the United States for Europe to come out and say that and to say, well, actually, on this question, we're going to be cautious. We're not necessarily going to blame Iran. Now, that was on Monday. On Tuesday, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel came out and she did put the blame quite squarely on the shoulders of Iran. So I think there's some division within Europe, and we can talk about that in a moment. That's important to this as well, on how to respond to this. But still, it's worth pausing and just really pointing out the fact that, you know, Europe can't decide who to back, America or Iran. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty worrying.
Right. So it does show there's clearly a very strong strain of anti-Americanism among quite a lot of European leaders. And it seems like the whole way that the United States has been trying to put the pressure on Iran over its nuclear program, secondarily over its missile program, over its terrorist activities, that Europe has been pretty resistant to that in some ways. And yet at the same time, Europe is itself facing threats from Iran. There have been some pretty high-profile attempted assassinations, and you know, there's quite a lot that Europe has against Iran itself. So there, at the same time that you have this kind of desire to undermine what America is doing, you also have signs within Europe of a certain hardening approach toward Iran.
Right, and that's why you have this kind of schizophrenic response. You know, I think at the one time you've got a lot of hatred for America, and that's a lot of the time manifested as a lot of hatred towards President Trump. And Europe loves to be able to portray America as kind of this ignorant buffoon, and especially Donald Trump as this kind of ignorant buffoonish operator on the international scene. And the Iran deal they see as a wonderful opportunity to do that and to kind of get the entire rest of the world against the United States. If they sign with Russia and China, you know, it's everybody versus the United States. So on the one hand, yes, they're kind of leaning towards opposing the United States there. On the other hand, Iran is genuinely dangerous, and Iran isn't right next door to America. They do have a special hatred for America, but they're not right next door. They're much closer to Europe. And so on the other hand, you have the fact that Iran does pose a genuine risk. And so over the last year or so, you've seen especially intelligence agencies within Europe pushing and saying things like, look, Iran has been carrying out assassinations on our soil. They've been carrying out all of these very dangerous and deadly attacks. We need to do something about it. And you have seen recently Europe start to introduce some sanctions on Iran in response to those attacks, or in response to those assassinations. And then this week on Sunday, you had The Bild, which is Germany's largest newspaper, this big mass circulation tabloid that has a huge following, saying that Germany needs to stop appeasing Iran. You know, they said there must finally be an end with the appeasement, the talk of Iranian partners, an agreement that supposedly makes the world safer. The current Iranian government, the mullahs, are not partners. For us and for our most important allies, they are only one thing, a threat. And we've not seen that kind of statements coming out of Europe about Iran at all recently, not quite that strong that we saw from Bild. So you've got a clear sign of Europe hardening and potentially getting ready to change their position when it comes to Iran as well.
So both of these trends that we're talking about, this desire to undermine America and this hardening toward Iran, are consistent with Bible prophecy. As somewhat paradoxical as they might be, or as much as this might kind of reflect in a schizophrenic foreign policy, they are both what we would expect based on prophecy.
That's right. I mean, perhaps the most straightforward is to talk about this confrontation that's coming with Europe and Iran. This is when the Bible talks about Iran in Bible prophecy, it refers to them as Iranian-led terrorism and radical Islam as the king of the south. And it talks about, in Daniel 11, this clash between the king of the south and this king of the north. And you can prove that that king of the north is referring to this European power. So yeah, when the Bible talks about Iran, it doesn't talk about this big epic clash with America. Europe is the one that it's talking about. And so in Europe's hardening attitude, you see that building, and you can prove a lot of that from our free booklet, The King of the South. But at the same time, the Bible talks about Europe going on after that clash with Iran and clashing with Britain and America. Mm-hmm. And so you can see the groundwork growing for that as well in this growing divide. I had an article in the Trumpet print almost exactly a year ago, Europe and America, they've lost that loving feeling, that goes through some of that just anger and hatred that's building in Europe to America, and the way that that's manifested, especially in outspoken criticism of President Trump, but then also what the Bible says about that as well, because the Bible says a lot about this Europe-America relationship, where Europe thinks, or America thinks they can trust Europe until they find out that actually Europe never really liked them very much, and they're very ready to stab America in the back when they get that opportunity. So two huge Bible prophecies, two huge prophetic trends that both tie into this story.
Yeah, well, we'll put a link to that article of yours in the show notes for the program, as well as to The King of the South, the booklet that Gerald Fleury wrote. And we also, what Warren was talking about, we have an article up called U.S. Assets in Iraq Are Under Attack. That will be coming shortly on thetrumpet.com if it's not up already. You can watch for that. We appreciate that, Richard and Warren. Thank you for that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Another front on which Iran is pursuing its pushy foreign policy is in South America. So even though the United States isn't directly prophesied to have this confrontation with Iran, we are seeing that Iran is continuing to push against even the United States outside of the Middle East. Brent's article, by the way, in this coming Trumpet, really does a good job of putting all of this in its prophetic context. You can watch for that. That'll be going up next week. But right now, we'll just look at what Iran is doing in South America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Iran has been in the news a lot these past several weeks. And at the beginning of this month, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States weighed in, just reminding everyone of another front Iran's been heavily involved in for about a decade. He said on June 5th that Iran and Hezbollah have a solid base of operations in South America, in alliance with the narco-dictatorship of Nicolas Maduro. If we fail in Venezuela, it represents a victory for terrorism, transnational organized crime, and anti-Semitism. And he's hearkening back even back when Ahmad Ahmadinejad was the president of Iran. He met often with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. After Chavez died, Iran and Hezbollah started developing close relationships with a man who's now the Minister of Industries in Venezuela, Tarek El Asami. He used to be the vice president. Now he's the Minister of Industries. And when you look at Venezuela today to see that the Minister of Industries doesn't have a ton to do, because there's not any functioning industries down there except for the drug industry. And that's primarily where El Asami's focus is. He has close relationships with Hezbollah, caught forging at least 8,000 passports for Hezbollah agents to move into Venezuela. Hezbollah's two biggest sources of income are gifts from Iran and drug money from the Americas.
So one would expect if the United States sanctions against Iran are drying up that source of income, it would make the income coming from Venezuela and drug money that much more valuable to Hezbollah.
Right. Hezbollah and Iran definitely have two birds they're after with their efforts in Iran. One, yes, Hezbollah uses drug money from the Americas to fund terrorism in Syria and across the Middle East. And so with Iran under sanction and with some other economic problems, that money's drying up. Hezbollah needs the drug money that it's getting from Venezuela. Except Venezuela has pretty much no functioning industry right now except the drug industry and the smuggling industry, both things that Hezbollah is very good at. So they need Hezbollah's expertise to shore up that revenue. So monetarily, it definitely makes sense for both Maduro and the Iranian Hezbollah axis to be involved in this type of activity. But as a number of security analysts have pointed out, Iran is also an ideological enemy of the United States. And throughout the Cold War, both the Soviets and the Chinese found that if you're up against a rival too powerful to confront directly militarily, the drug trade is an amazing way to make some money on the side while weakening an enemy from within. I'd written an article a few months back how China's actually doing that same thing to today. They're an ideological enemy of the United States. They don't want to confront them directly, and so they're using fentanyl and the drug trade underhandedly to undermine the United States. And Iran's doing the exact same thing. They've through Hezbollah as their primary proxy, they've partnered with some of the most successful drug agencies actually in Mexico, but especially Venezuela. Mexico, they have to work with the cartels on an individual basis, but Venezuela, I mean, the government itself is the Venezuelan government is probably the world's biggest drug cartel. They don't list it. They list Sinaloa because Sinaloa is a proper cartel, not a government. But that is what the Venezuelan government does.
It's quite chilling to think about enemies of the United States being able to leverage our own sins and our own lusts against us. This type of thing, that Americans are actually paying money to drug cartels that are being aided by terrorists from the Middle East.
Right. No, that is extremely chilling. And even the American government, not the current administration, but the previous one, has some blood on its hands regarding this. Isn't that the Politico broke the story back in December 2017? That was actually a condition with Barack Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, you know, the famous nuclear deal. We're going to lift sanctions on Iran, and they can do nuclear enrichment if they promise not to make a bomb out of it. But that was one of the conditions, is the Obama administration agreed to turn a blind eye to Hezbollah's nefarious activities in Venezuela. And so now that the Trump administration's racking up the pressure on Venezuela, but Hezbollah is much, much, much more deeply entrenched in that country than they were before Obama took office. And so between the U.S. government turning a blind eye to this for so many years and America's own burgeoning drug addiction, the statistics go up every year as the amount of overdose deaths in America. It's now the leading cause of death for those under 55, as this money goes to the Middle East. But there is a prophecy we mention often in Leviticus 26, verse 16. That's it's the blessings and cursings chapter. It's the cursings that come on a nation that turns from God's law. And he said, "Well, I'll even appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning ague." And that burning ague, it's kind of and consumption kind of has the connotation of like disease and things like that. Even maybe this is a little speculative, but it does almost sound like it's linking terror and other social malaises like drug addiction that go right hand in hand in so many cases. But we're definitely seeing the terrorism part, where this is a legit terrorist threat to America when you've got drug cartels and Islamic terrorists working in Venezuela. I mean, Venezuela is several hundred miles away from the United States, but it's right on the main artery the drug cartels use to traffic. If you can, that's where the cocaine comes from, is Colombia and Venezuela, and the cartels, they're pretty good at getting the cocaine from all the way up from down there across the Rio Grande. So if Hezbollah wanted to smuggle anything else, that would be...
Well, it does seem like there have been reports or at least warnings for years that that Hezbollah and terrorist groups could be actually smuggling people into the United States, that we could have terrorists in the United States thanks to these drug corridors.
Right. And I mean, they've definitely come up with law enforcement agencies have been talking about Hezbollah cells in the United States for a long time. I think they said right now they're not committing a ton of acts of terrorism, just because they'd rather sell you drugs than blow you up, and then use the money to blow people up in the Middle East. But as Iran's geopolitical objectives change, they do have, I don't actually have the numbers right off the top of my head. I looked it up one time and it was pretty shocking, just the number of estimated Hezbollah agents in the United States that could be conducting terrorist attacks if they decided that was a higher priority than drug smuggling.
Mm. Well, all of those curses that you talked about in those chapters, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, you just see those becoming more and more relevant. As you see America's sins creating these kinds of opportunities for the enemies of the country. We'll put a link to that article that you were describing, that you wrote about how China is waging a drug war against America, in the show notes today. We appreciate that, Andrew. Hezbollah isn't the only entity hostile to the U.S. that is setting up in America's backyard in South America. There's also Russia. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a fleet of Russian warships crossed through the Panama Canal on Monday. They entered it from the Pacific side there, and they headed east. And now they're in the Caribbean Sea, headed apparently to Cuba with a possible stopover in Venezuela. And this fleet is led by Russia's most modern warship. It's the Admiral Gorshkov. That one's only been in service since July of last year. So this ship has been in service not even a year, but it's one of Russia's most advanced vessels, and the Russians have been getting quite a lot of use out of it in the short time that it's been in service. It left Russia back in February from a part on the far north there, very close to the border with Finland, and it made stops in Africa and Sri Lanka and China, and then it headed across the Pacific and stopped in Ecuador before crossing through the Panama Canal this week. So this vessel and its accompanying ships are now right in the U.S.'s neighborhood. They're traveling through the Caribbean Sea near those shipping lanes that the U.S. economy depends on so heavily. And Admiral Gorshkov has advanced nuclear air defense capabilities. It can launch caliber nuclear cruise missiles, which can strike targets up to 1,500 miles away. Those are nuclear capable. So if this Russian fleet visits Venezuela, it could add fresh tensions to the dispute there with the U.S. and most of the world in support of the opposition, Juan Guaido, but with China and Russia supporting, who Andrew just talked about, Nicolas Maduro, the socialist dictator there. But even if Admiral Gorshkov and the rest of this fleet doesn't stop in Venezuela and just goes straight on to Cuba, it would still be furthering Russia's broader goal of just establishing deeper influence in Latin America and the Caribbean. The War Zone wrote about this on Tuesday and said, quote, "It's the latest example of a larger trend on the part of the Kremlin to ensure it has a firm base of operations in the U.S.'s backyard."
Yeah. Well, yeah, it does seem like we've heard it's kind of this salami slicing that you're talking about. Russia's strategy with Crimea, Ukraine, and Eastern Europe, that it makes a little move, and then that just kind of is the thin end of the wedge for larger moves down the road. But we've been seeing, we've talked about the presence that it's established in Venezuela, and it seems in Cuba that it has had some influence there. But you just wonder if it had been so bold as what it's doing right now at the beginning, if the United States would have countenanced this. And maybe you could just tell us what the U.S.'s response has been, and if, like this individual that you just quoted, this is part of a larger trend that Russia is undertaking, how successful it's been to this point.
Sure, yeah. So far, the U.S. has not said or done much. I think if there is a stopover in Venezuela, that could change. If it goes straight on to Cuba, I doubt there would be much of a comment on it. But it's hard to say. As you said, a lot of these sorts of buildups are done in a way that keeps it below the threshold of activity that would warrant behavior or a response from the United States. But we've seen it not just in Venezuela and Cuba, but also in Nicaragua, Bolivia, Ecuador, where Russia just made a stop. The Russians are really deepening their influence there. And then, of course, Russia's main partner, China, is doing the same thing, although with a bit more of a focus on commercial trade. In the last couple of decades, China's trade with Latin America has just exploded. It's 30 times what it was in the year 2000. China is now the number one trade partner for some of the region's largest countries. And when you put all this together, it shows that Russia and China's influence in Latin America has really become something formidable in recent years. And with trips like the one that Russia is now making there, it's on course to grow just that much more meaningful and robust.
The Obama administration famously dismantled the Monroe Doctrine, which would have kept the influence of these Asian giants out of the Western Hemisphere, or at least that was certainly the aim. The Trump administration has pushed back against that to some degree, but I guess Russia and China maybe haven't really taken that warning to heart, it seems.
Yeah, that's true. I read a headline earlier this week in which the Monroe Doctrine was evoked, but it seems like it's never done with the sort of force that would actually reverse course from these Asian nations.
So just looking at this prophetically, why is this so important?
Well, Bible prophecy talks about a time in the future when the United States will be besieged by enemies. Deuteronomy 28:52 says it will be besieged in all its gates. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has written quite a lot about this besiegement in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, and how it'll happen at the hands of a European power in conjunction with Russia and China. So Mr. Flurry has pointed to prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 that talk about this group of nations that are cooperating together, and they're blocking the U.S. out of world trade, and they even besiege it. So to see Russia, you know, just getting more and more of a foothold there in Latin America, it's I think it's easy to see how that's creating the conditions for this prophesied besiegement to happen.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Before we take a break, one more short story about Iranian-influenced attacks. These in Saudi Arabia. For this, we'll go back to Warren Reinch.
A string of recent Houthi rebel drone attacks against Saudi Arabia just occurred in the last couple months. On June 17th and May 26th, two separate Saudi airports were attacked. But then the same airport was attacked 3 days in a row, May 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. The 21st, these Houthi forces attacked an arms depot at this Najran airport using a KSF-2 drone. The New York Times reported last year that this airport was a U.S. intelligence analyst base. This base was used to assist Saudi forces, and U.S. Green Berets were also deployed in the area. So this is, once again, just another attack against the U.S., obviously against the Saudis as well, but it really does just show what we've been talking about a lot today. Earlier, there was even another really important attack. This was something we've written up on the Trumpet. On May 14th, Houthis used 7 drones to attack a major east-west pipeline. This pipeline is very crucial. A lot of Saudi's oil is located in the east of Saudi Arabia, which means if it's going to ship that oil to Europe or to North America, it's going to have to go through the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, all the way around the Saudi Peninsula. So this pipeline just cuts that time significantly. It allows them to bypass that vital oil artery in the Strait of Hormuz. Instead, they can just ship it across into the Red Sea and then go through the Suez Canal. So this attack then didn't damage the pipeline very, very much, but it was enough to stop oil flowing through it for several days, which has a large impact on the global economy. But the whole point of these drone attacks is that they aren't just these Houthi rebels. Once again, this is another terrorist organization, another Iranian-backed organization, and a lot of evidence shows that these drones aren't even Houthi drones. They're actually Iranian drones, or they're built by Iran. The Conflict Armament Research has this really good article. It's a report that they have about a dozen photos they've taken of these different Houthi drones that they've gathered. And in it, they say this. They gathered it and they said, also this also suggests that the KSF-1, which is the predecessor to the KSF-2, is imported rather than designed or manufactured in Yemen. And they say that this actually came from Iran. It was shipped from Iran through Oman and then into Yemen. So this just shows that, once again, Iran is using these shadowy methods. They're using these drones, which are much harder to find than a missile. If they shot missiles, which are usually a lot more destructive, missiles can be shot down. They have a larger radar that makes it just a lot easier to target. But these drones have a very small radar signature, and that makes it very hard for them to know that these drones are coming. So they're in that way, they're more stealthy, and they can sneak up on the enemy, and then that gives Iran the surprise attack factor.
Well, I would encourage everyone to stay tuned to thetrumpet.com for that article by Brent Noctegal about will the United States and Iran go to war, because he talks about Iran's effort to control oil routes and to disrupt oil shipping as a power play, and puts that in the context of the prophecies that show this conflict that will arise between Iran and Europe, and the fact that you see this kind of tension increasing between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and these attacks on Saudi interests is also very prophetically significant because of the division between these two main powers in the Middle East that is explained in prophecy directly. All of that's explained in Mr. Fleury's booklet, The King of the South. But do pay attention and look for that article by Brent Noctegal. That'll go up on the website next week when the August edition of the Trumpet Magazine is posted. We appreciate that very much. Warren, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, China's president visits North Korea. We have news about a new European fighter jet program and an effort to fight internet censorship. We'll be right back.
Listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
China's president was in North Korea this week. To learn why, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, over the last few weeks, the world's anticipation has been building for a different meeting. The big one coming up next week between Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Donald Trump. That one's supposed to take place in Japan next week at the G20 meeting. And, you know, the U.S. and China have been locked into this intensifying trade war for months. So a lot could be pinned on the outcome of that meeting. And on Monday of this week, while all of that anticipation was building, China came out and announced, you know, this was a total surprise announcement, and they said Xi Jinping will be visiting North Korea in the next few days. And then yesterday and today, that visit by Xi to North Korea has been underway. It's the first time in 14 years that a Chinese leader has visited North Korea, and both China and North Korea are really playing this up. For China, normally when they talk about visits to North Korea, they call them official friendly visits, but this time they're billing it as an actual state visit. So that label is intended just to ascribe a lot of formality and importance to the visit. And then North Korea is also making the most of this. China is North Korea's only major ally, so the North has just really rolled out the red carpet for Xi Jinping. They had 250,000 North Koreans lining the streets to greet him, and then they treated him to one of North Korea's famous propaganda shows, where thousands of North Koreans held up placards, which put together made this gigantic face of Xi Jinping. They sang a song to him called "I Love Thee, China." So there was really just a lot of pomp and fanfare there.
Nobody does it like North Korea.
Nobody does.
So you wonder how much, I guess this is a bit of a tangent, but how much Donald Trump's courting of Kim Jong-un kind of paved the way for Xi to make this scale of a visit.
Yeah, I wonder if that could, maybe Xi didn't want to feel left out in a way, seeing the famous bromance sort of that's blossoming. You know, Trump often talks about the love letters he receives from Kim Jong-un. Xi Jinping may have felt a little bit left out, and he wants to shore up his own affectionate friendship there.
So what was the official purpose?
Well, officially, China and North Korea said that they were celebrating the 70th anniversary of their diplomatic ties between China and North Korea. But that anniversary has come and gone many times over the years, including the 65th and the 60th, without any visits. Mm-hmm. So it looks to me like this trip is intended for an audience of one, a man sitting in the Oval Office in Washington, D.C. You know, Xi Jinping's had a pretty rough go of it over the last few weeks. Very embarrassing protests in Hong Kong, a lot of criticism over his handling of the trade war, even from within his own government, criticism of just the general mismanagement of the Chinese economy. So this meeting gives him a chance to kind of jockey himself back into a position of relevance and importance on a pretty important global issue, North Korea's nuclear program. China is responsible for about 90% of North Korea's global trade, and along with Russia, they're the main reason why North Korea even has the leeway and the freedom to behave as it does, you know, antagonizing the world and all that. So Xi Jinping, I think, in the lead up to this meeting with Donald Trump next week, he wants to remind President Trump and the world that he could really make a big difference in these North Korean negotiations. He wants to enter into that meeting with as much leverage as he possibly can and just show President Trump that if the U.S. really wants a deal with North Korea, China's going to have to be a big player in that too.
Tell us about the U.N. resolution on North Korea this week.
Yes, in the lead up to this China-North Korea meeting, China and Russia together use their United Nations veto power to block a resolution that would have said, well, it was a declaration against North Korea saying that they've imported an excessive amount of oil. There was a cap put on the amount of North Korean or refined petroleum products that North Korea is allowed to import every year. They're supposed to bring in only 500,000 barrels a year. And so the United States and 25 other countries said that the evidence is, you know, overwhelming, that North Korea brought in far more than that in 2018. They actually brought in 3.5 million barrels, so that's seven times the number that they're allowed to. But Russia and China stepped in and they blocked this resolution, just as they did with a very similar resolution in July of last year. That limit on North Korea, it's designed to really put a squeeze on the economy and even on the military. Without oil, it's hard for them to function. And so that limit is designed to make North Korea willing to come to the negotiation table, make them more willing to give up their dangerous nuclear weapons program. But here we see that thanks to Russia and China, the declaration failed. And this year, North Korea is on pace to also greatly exceed that cap on oil products once again. And all of this adds up to make North Korea very unlikely to want to negotiate, to want to give up its nuclear weapons.
for as much stir as North Korea's activities have caused over the last few years, you can't help but be reminded of what Gerald Fleury said, that the real issue is not North Korea, it is North Korea's patrons, China being chief, but also Russia.
That's exactly right. Yes, it was in 2017 that he said, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korean crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely. And Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." End quote. So, yeah, Russia and China meeting with North Korea's leader as frequently as they have been and using their UN power to protect it, all of that just proves that Mr. Fleury was exactly right. It's those two nations that are really keeping North Korea afloat. And his statement there, you know, he mentions Bible prophecies. Those are mentioned in, well, they're written in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Revelation. And they show that it'll be Russia and China that lead this end-time Asian military bloc. Mm-hmm. And we have an article called "Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower" that really goes into all those prophecies and shows that North Korea could very well play a role in that end-time Asian bloc, but it would not be as a lead nation. It would just be under the leadership of Russia mm-hmm. and China.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. Germany signed a deal on a new European fighter jet program this week, along with a couple of other European nations. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so at the Paris Air Show earlier this week, it's a huge event in the aviation industry. And while there, the defense ministers from Germany, France, and Spain signed up to participate in Europe's future combat air system. So this future combat system, it will design the Europe's sixth generation stealth fighter jet. It will also include, or could also include, drones, missiles, aircraft defense, you know, a whole combat system, as is in the name. The desire is to have this up and running by around 2040 or so, but you're seeing some of the biggest European nations get together and try and work together to create a state-of-the-art next-generation fighter.
Would you say that the cooperation and the effort to come together is as significant or even more significant than the specific nature of the program, if this isn't going to be available for another 20 years?
Well, I don't know. I could see events speeding that cooperation up as well, mm-hmm. Or that time scale up if they decide that they do need it more urgently. I mean, yeah, I think if you look at the trend and the motivation behind it, that does say a lot about Europe. You've got, well, at the moment, you know, if you want a fifth generation stealth fighter jet, there's only one place you can really get that. That's the United States. I guess there's also a Sukhoi fighter. I think the academics are arguing as to how effective that is. Regardless, Europe is, you know, all of their missiles and everything are integrated into the NATO system. They can't really practically go and buy a fighter jet from Russia. So really for them, the only option is the United States. So what you're seeing here is them saying, we don't want to rely on the United States. Mm-hmm. You're seeing basically France especially and Spain saying, well, we can't do this on our own. We're just not big enough of a player to develop our own fighter jet. We're going to empower Germany. We'll work with Germany. We would rather look to Germany and having a European solution than we would to the United States. So it really ties into what we were talking about in the first half. It's a very practical manifestation of Europe trying to go their own way and rely on themselves. And at the same Paris Air Show, you had a significant European-Italian naval initiative, and you had some other signals of cooperation between them as Europe tries to turn their back on the United States in a military way, with their military hardware.
Where would you send someone who was interested in more information specifically about Europe's military buildup and unification?
Well, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, he wrote about these military programs, and in fact, exactly this military program, the Future Air Combat System, back in the February 2009 Trumpet print edition. In that article, he wrote, "France is already taking concrete steps to build a European army alongside Germany. Perhaps this is why Macron is so bold as to criticize the US. His criticisms imply that Europe no longer needs NATO because it's building its own army." And he went through all of these different cooperative weapon systems that Europe is developing. And these tie, as he points out in that article, very specifically into Bible prophecy. The Bible talks about these this power rising in Europe, and it says, well, they give their strength and their power to this, you know, this coming empire. They all work together. Well, Herbert W. Armstrong described it in May 1953, saying that these powerful European nations will combine their forces. And as he talks, as Mr. Flurry talks about in that article, you can look at other scriptures in Revelation that describe some very modern weaponry, where, you know, you've got an ancient writer, the Apostle John, trying to find words to describe some of these modern tanks and fighter jets and helicopters. So you can see some very specific prophecies on Europe getting together and developing these weapon systems. And we can look at the news and we see Europe getting together, developing these weapon systems. I find the timescale might be a bit out right now, but when you look at events like Jeremiah talked about coming out of Crimea and the rise of Russia, you know, you can really see them putting their foot down on the gas as they get this organized. But it's a very direct fulfillment from Bible prophecy, and you can read Mr. Flurry's article that goes through that.
Well, we will put a link to that article, the title of that, "France Rejects America and Empowers Germany." The link will be in the show notes for today's program. We also have an article that is about to appear on the Trumpet site, "Will Germany Lead Europe's Air Defense?" And we have our trend article, "Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military." Thanks for that, Richard. One last story here: high-profile cases in the U.S. of censorship by Facebook, YouTube, and other tech giants lately, especially censorship of conservative voices, have many people concerned about free speech on the internet. Some lawmakers are trying to address the problem. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's been study after study after study just quantifying the effect that big tech giants like Twitter, Facebook, Google, YouTube, which is a subsidiary of Google, actually, censoring conservative speech, banning conservative accounts, taking down conservative videos. I could actually talk about that for quite a while. I think we'll... But I'm not the only one who's noticed it. There's actually a senator in Congress right now who's actually proposed a bill entitled "Ending Support for the Internet Censorship Act." This is proposed by Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri. Although when you look into the details of the bill, it might be one of those cases of the medicine being worse than the disease. In that he's looking at the way, how do you end this censorship against conservatives? And he's like, well, right now there's laws on the books that basically say only the federal government can sue a big tech company for bias. The individuals or state governments, there's some pretty stringent restrictions on them. He's saying that that bill needs to be amended to where every 2 years a company like Google would actually have to go before some federal bureaucrat and prove that they're not biased for that law to apply. If they can't prove they're not biased, then they're open to litigation. And that will put the pressure on them to bring their search algorithms back to political neutrality. It's definitely getting some support because, I mean, there's a lot of people who realize that this censorship amongst conservatives, the censorship on conservatives is a problem. I mean, Google's is responsible for about 90% of all web searches. So if they're biased against a political viewpoint, there's going to be a lot of people who don't see that viewpoint. But at the end of the day, when the government is determining who's biased or not, that does come down to a decision by a particular agency, sometimes a particular person. Mm-hmm. Republicans are supporting this right now, or at least some Republicans are supporting this right now because they're hoping the Trump administration will save them from censorship. But once those laws are on the books, it's whatever future administration there could be has the power to determine if you're biased or not, or or what if you're giving more attention to this political viewpoint than that political viewpoint, then we're going to open you up to all sorts of litigation. And it just it brings these companies under government control, which actually makes censorship even easier in some cases. Now, right now, yeah, I don't have a ton of time. When you look into it, there, some of this is already happening. Where Google has a ton of collusion with deep state agencies already. A bill like this is not going to help that. But we can put a Kia David link maybe in the show notes. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, has a Kia David program titled Daniel 8:12, A Dual Prophecy, that talks to this prophecy about truth being cast to the ground in the end time. And whether it's being done by government or whether it's being done by companies, there is definitely an abundance of evidence of truth, a conspiracy against truth, making it harder and harder to find.
Mm. Well, we'll definitely put that link in the show notes. Thank you for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. That link and all the others that we talked about can be found on the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, so you can access the articles and the literature that we discussed. You can email your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Warren Reinch, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Groucho Marx. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.